From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is either the most expensive assassination attempt in world history, or it's the most damaging psychological campaign to provoke a coup.
War Plan Iraq, a conversation with Milan Rai. But first, we'll go to Mei Ying Welsh, reporting from Baghdad. Then Maria Carrion in Madrid, talking about the Spanish resistance. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. and British warplanes have begun an intense bombardment of Republican Guard bunkers outside Baghdad to prepare for a ground assault on the Iraqi capital. Army helicopter gunships in the front line of the attack were forced to turn back after encountering a hail of small arms fire. One of the Army's Apache helicopters went down. Shortly afterward, Iraqi state television showed two crewmen, 26-year-old Chief Warrant Officer Ronald Young Jr. and 30-year-old Chief Warrant Officer David Williams. The airmen were the second set of POWs displayed by the Iraqis. Troops from the U.S. Army 5th Corps have formed a front line about 50 miles south of Baghdad. Vast convoys of tanks and ground forces are racing up from Kuwait to join them. The U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division is attempting to push towards Baghdad, but is stalled by a sandstorm. Retired U.S. Army General Barry McCaffrey, commander in the 91 Gulf War, told the BBC the battle for Baghdad could be brutal and result in as many as 3,000 coalition casualties. He also said War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has misjudged the nature of the conflict by not sending in more troops to take the Iraqi capital. Barry McCaffrey is the retired general who investigative reporter Seymour Hersh wrote about, talking about how McCaffrey ordered the bombing of retreating Iraqi forces in 1991 along a six-lane highway from Kuwait City to Basra in February of 91. An Australian pilot has refused a U.S. command to bomb a target in Iraq. Australian military spokesman Brigadier Mike Hannon said the crew chose not to complete the mission because they could not positively identify the target. He said the crew's decision reflects the Australian military's, quote, strong commitment to the laws of armed conflict. Canberra has emphasized that its forces will refuse to attack civilian targets, including key bridges, dams, and other vital infrastructure of the kind bombed by the U.S. in the 1991 Gulf War. U.S. officials told CNN intelligence reports suggest Republican Guard units might have been ordered to use chemical weapons against U.S. forces if they cross a, quote, red line drawn around Baghdad. It is still extremely difficult to get any information in Iraqi casualties. The London Guardian is reporting in Nasiriya a U.S. warplane dropped up to 4 cluster bombs on a civilian area, killing 10, wounding 200. In northeast Iraq, U.S. missiles hit a village, killing 34, and Kurdish officials say at least 150 people were killed by U.S. bombing over the weekend in northern Iraq. The BBC has just reported bodies of at least 30 Iraqis have been seen along the road from the southern town of Nasiriyah. 39 U.S. and British military personnel have been confirmed killed since the Iraqi conflict began. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the BBC reports several thousand U.S. troops are advancing through the town of Nasiriyah after protracted clashes with Iraqi forces. British commanders have declared Basra a, quote, legitimate military target after encountering unexpectedly stiff resistance there. According to coalition military sources, Iraqi forces that were defending areas south of Basra have pulled back into the town. And a British commander has declared the southern Iraqi port town of Umm Qasr, quote, safe and open. A British Army spokeswoman said aid shipments through the port could begin today. The London Guardian and Al Jazeera are reporting the U.S. is quickly losing the battle for hearts and minds as civilian casualties increase and humanitarian aid is slow to arrive. One local resident told The Guardian, "We were happy when the U.S. promised to get rid of Saddam Hussein and his regime, but this is replacing Saddam with another form of tyranny." Arab foreign ministers have condemned the invasion of Iraq during Monday's meeting of the Arab League in Cairo. The ministers called for the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of, quote, invasion forces from the country. But today, Iraqi Foreign Minister Naji Sabri accused Arab countries hosting U.S.-led forces of stabbing the Iraqi people in the back. He called on Arab nations to provide oil to the U.S. and to stop providing oil to the U.S. and Britain and to close their airspace to coalition troops. Stocks plunged yesterday and the Dow Jones Index fell by over 300 points in its worst day since September. This follows the best week the Dow had in over two decades when it appeared the coalition forces would achieve a lightning victory in Iraq. The massive sell-off came as the Washington Post, London Guardian, and other papers began reporting Iraq may become a quagmire for Americans. Meanwhile, a new Washington Post ABC News poll has found over half the country believes coalition forces will sustain significant casualties in the war, and nearly half expect the war to last months rather than days or weeks. Both figures are up nearly 40% from Thursday. Despite all of this, U.S. Commander General Tommy Franks last night insisted coalition forces are making, quote, rapid and in some cases dramatic progress. President Bush plans to ask Congress for $75 billion to pay for the invasion of Iraq. The money covers expenses only for the next 6 months. It does not cover the costs of post-war occupation and reconstruction. A U.S. presidential envoy arrived in Turkey on Monday to press Turkey to refrain from sending troops across the border. But Turkey claimed the troops are needed to deter a possible Kurdish uprising in the north. Syria has lodged a protest with the United States and Britain after a U.S. missile struck a Syrian passenger bus carrying 37 civilians. Five people were killed and 10 injured in the attack. Iran's deputy interior minister has said Iran reserves the right to fire on coalition aircraft in its airspace if they fail to heed a warning to leave. Meanwhile, several hundred British soldiers have been dropped along the Iran-Iraqi border in the south. An explosion damaged part of the British Council building in Beirut in the early hours of this morning. A bomb has also been thrown at Britain's honorary consulate in a port city in Ecuador. In India, authorities say half a dozen armed rebels bombed a warehouse in the south of the country, razing it to the ground. The warehouse was stocked with Pepsi bottles. Human Rights Watch charged Monday that Egyptian anti-war activists and protesters are being subjected to torture. The New York-based human rights group also said hundreds of demonstrators have been injured in brutal police crackdowns. In San Francisco, more than 100 people were arrested in another day of anti-war protests. In Germany, anti-war demonstrators and police clashed outside the U.S. consulate in Hamburg. Peace rallies emptied schools across Italy on Monday. And Harry Fisher died this weekend. He fought in the Spanish Civil War against Franco and the rise of fascism. On Saturday, as he was marching against the U.S. invasion of Iraq, he had a heart attack. He was 92 years old.
Absolutely nothing. To me.
Edwin Starr here on Democracy Now!'s Unembedded War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Jeremy Scahill, who recently turned from Iraq, where he has been four times covering the events leading up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Welcome, Jeremy.
Well, you know, the disaster just continues for U.S. forces in the south now that they've abandoned the British forces and left them in Basra. British commanders are saying that they are facing the prospect of having to fight urban warfare in the city. One of the commanders quoted as saying, "We always had the idea everyone in this area hated Saddam." You know, it's incredible how they just don't get history in Iraq. It's not about Saddam Hussein. And it's something that we've reported on a lot on this show. They're occupying someone else's country. And I think that that's what the U.S. war planners didn't expect when they went into the south of Iraq. They thought that hatred for Saddam equaled love for the quote-unquote liberation forces. And they're finding resistance in a lot of these areas actually from civilian militias, according to reports we're seeing.
And British commanders declaring Basra a, quote, legitimate military target after encountering unexpectedly stiff resistance there. Basra, a city of how many?
Well, people keep saying it's 1.3 million, but actually there's about 2 million people in Basra and the surrounding area. This is one of the most fought over areas of land in history. It used to be called the Venice of the East. Now it's anything but that. Because it has these canals that run through the city, it's going to be a very difficult place for these forces to secure. And yes, sentiment in that city is against Saddam Hussein in many parts of it, but it's also against the United States. These are the people that have been bombed in these so-called no-fly zones heavily since 1998. They suffer the worst from the U.S.-led sanctions, and there's also a desecularization in that area that absolutely has to be factored in when you talk about will people resist.
Jeremy, we're going to go live right now to Baghdad to Mei Ying Welsh, independent reporter on the ground there. Welcome to Democracy Now, Mei Ying.
Hi, thanks.
Can you describe where you are and what the situation is like right now as the United States and Britain say they are moving in on Baghdad?
Well, I'm in the parking lot of the Ministry of Information. That's a building that most journalists really fear is going to be destroyed at some point. And even ministry officials themselves are taking that very seriously. Basically, that building clears out by dusk, and there's nobody there, not a soul, because people just don't want to take a chance. And in fact, the risk factor's gone up by a lot, because just today some journalists were telling people in the press center that they believed that attack would come today or tonight. So we could be seeing this building blow up right in front of us at some time in the near future. I'm a good distance away from it, separated by a residential apartment block, so I'm not too worried about my safety, but there's a huge, tremendous sandstorm going on around us. The entire sky is pinky yellow. The wind is blowing very hard. It's hard to stand outside because the sand gets into your eyes, and it's really obscured the vision of the city. It's not possible to see very far, but we can hear the bombing, the massive bombing that was going on just perhaps a half an hour ago in the southern end of the city.
Mei Ying, we know, as Amy read in the headlines, that the Arab League has condemned the U.S. and British attack on Iraq, has called for the forces of the U.S. and Britain to leave the country and for no Arab country to support this action. We understand that the Iraqi Vice President Taha Yassin Ramadan has just held a press conference in Baghdad. What did he say?
Well, today he condemned that condemnation as being too little too late. He said that, you know, the Arab states, they should have done this before the aggression began, and now, you know, it's just kind of, why bother, because the aggression has already happened. He did call upon them to wage an oil embargo against the United States and Britain to try and stop their economies, to use the oil weapon. He called on Arab states to use the oil weapon, and he said that if they don't take such measures, that many Arab governments in this region are going to fall. He also called upon them to close their U.S. embassies and noted that none of them had done so. So he seemed to be very frustrated with the position of the Arab countries and did not seem impressed at all that this condemnation had come out from the Arab League.
And what about how people are preparing for the attack on Baghdad right now?
Well, there's no new preparations being made, to my knowledge. People have been preparing for this war for a long time. Some people have been preparing for it for months. And a lot of the things they were preparing for have not come to pass. For instance, people were preparing for the electricity going out and the water going out. And, you know, they were buying a lot of water tanks, and they were buying candles and kerosene lamps. And, and sort of preparing for the worst, like what they experienced in 1991. But this hasn't happened so far. So, you know, the preparations people have made, I suppose, are just kind of an extra bonus. People are not really making any extra preparations right now, to my knowledge.
Mei Ying, we were just talking about the situation in the south of Iraq, where the U.S. has met resistance in Nasiriya, outside of Karbala as well, the Shiite holy city, also in Basra. What is the view from people you're talking about there in the Iraqi capital to the situation in the south? How do people view the progress of this so far as Iraqi defense is concerned?
Well, to be honest, there's tremendous pride here in the fact that these cities like Souk al-Shuyukh, which is a very small town, and Basra, which has been notorious for rising up against the government in 1991 and for not being terribly loyal to the government, and Nasiriyah, another pocket similar to Basra. I mean, there's tremendous pride here that these people have actually fought and fought hard. And it's really interesting. I've noticed a real change of heart among people that I've been talking to here in Baghdad. Just 2 weeks ago, somebody who told me they were ready to welcome U.S. troops and they were hoping that they would come here and hoping that they would change the regime told me yesterday that he's had a 180-degree turnabout in his view of the situation. He told me that after he saw American troops trying to invade Basra and invading other cities, putting their flag up, he said, there's a limit. He said, I thought they were coming here to do a regime change. That's not what they're coming here for. They're coming here to invade the country and take it over. They're coming here to put their flag on my city. And he said, and I'll never let them do that. And in fact, he said that he was ready to fight. And this is, I was really shocked because this is somebody who's been telling me for quite a long time how much he wanted the Americans to come here.
We've just been reading the blog of Salam Pax, who we don't know who he is in Baghdad, reporting on his daily experiences. But he talks about the cloud now from the oil trenches on fire that are meant to obscure the sky in Baghdad to make it more difficult to target areas within. Is this what you're seeing as well?
Well, up until this sandstorm suddenly hit the city around, I don't know, 2 o'clock this afternoon, yes, there's a ring of smoke around the city, and it's, I don't know how effective it is in obscuring the vision of the American or British forces, but it looks like something much, much worse than pollution. It just looks like a ring of black smoke around the capital, and it doesn't, you know, rise up all the way into the sky. It just sort of hovers over the city. But now that there's this sandstorm here, you can't really see it anymore. All we see now is this pinky, yellowish color in the sky. Everything is that color.
Mei Ying, we only have a few more minutes here, but maybe you could paint a picture for us of what the devastation of the bombing looks like in Baghdad right now, the issue of civilian deaths and injuries. Talk about what's happened over these last 5 days.
Well, you know, most of the bombing over the last few days have been pretty much on the outskirts of Baghdad. There haven't been a lot of bombings in the center of the city. I mean, there's about 3 different military camps around the edges of the city, and they've been pounding those quite a lot, along with, I think, the railway line. I'm guessing here because I haven't seen it, but just judging from the direction that the noise came from. The destruction in terms of, you know, civilian casualties has been quite serious. Just yesterday we went to visit a purely residential neighborhood called Adamia, where actually the neighbors told us that one family had been completely buried under the rubble, a family of 6. We also were taken to a hospital to see some of the people that lived in that neighborhood. There was a family that was sitting down to breakfast at 1 o'clock. That might sound strange, sitting down to breakfast at 1 o'clock, but if you've stayed up all night worrying about getting bombed, then, you know, you might sleep in the morning and have your breakfast at 1. The family was eating breakfast when a missile hit very close to their house. The house collapsed. And there was a boy of 10 and a girl of 8 lying in bed. She had many bandages on her nose and face, and the boy's face was swollen, and their grandmother was still buried under the rubble. I mean, we also saw a mother with her three-year-old baby, both of them in bed, bandaged. I mean, it's a pretty dramatic sight to see these civilians who've been hurt, because these neighborhoods, they really don't have any major military targets in them. What they are is they're unfortunately near some of these military targets on the outskirts of town, like some of these army camps and stuff. So it's been, you know, kind of heart-wrenching to see some of the victims.
Mei Ying Welsh, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Mei Ying Welsh is an independent, unembedded reporter in Baghdad, Iraq. You are listening to Democracy Now! Stay safe, Mei Ying. We'll be back in a minute with Milan Rai. Then we'll be talking with Christopher Simpson and go to Spain to hear about the massive protest in Spain. Stay with us.
Must we drop? Turn civilizations back to rock? How many tears must we cry? And how many poor boys must die? How many centuries must pass till we are truly free at last? How many wars must we wage till we all can share center stage? Passions of eons cursing through our veins, ashes lit by neon, firestorm in our brain. We should be united by belief in things supreme. Instead, we're divided when nightmares invade dreams. When nightmares invade.
Nightmares here on Democracy Now!, One Mind Free. This is the War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill.
Well, Amy, we are going to be turning to the UK. We heard what you reported earlier about the British now facing this resistance in Basra and facing the prospect of having to fight urban warfare in this southern city of Iraq.
That's right. And the British commanders declaring Basra a, quote, legitimate military target because there's stiff resistance there, not emphasizing that there are roughly 2 million civilians there. And a British commander now declaring the southern Iraqi port town of Umm Qasr safe and open.
Although we've heard that before.
We go now to Milan Rai, who is author of a new book, War Plan Iraq, 10 Reasons Against War with Iraq. Milan Rai, who knows Iraq well, a human rights campaigner who believes forbidden fruit syringes, surgical gloves, and colostomy bags are the best weapons to wield against Saddam Hussein, has repeatedly risked jail by illegally smuggling into Iraq medical supplies banned under economic sanctions imposed on the country. But Milan Rai, right now, your thoughts about the U.S.-British invasion against Iraq.
Hello there. Well, I think that what we're seeing very clearly is an is that the allies, the US and the UK, are exposing the non-liberatory nature of this war. We were told that what the US wanted was a regime change in Iraq, but I think that the course of the war has demonstrated that it is about regime stabilization and merely leadership change. So just over a week ago, we had President Bush's ultimatum for Saddam Hussein and his sons to leave. That was interpreted by the FT a couple of days later as a coded call for a military coup in Iraq. Then we had the attempted assassination on the first night of bombing. And then we've had very intimidatory warnings from Donald Rumsfeld and others about what might follow and calls on the Iraqi military to change their stance. And just over a week ago, the Daily Telegraph, which is the most right-wing newspaper over here, which is very closely linked to the armed forces, had a report from their reporter in Kuwait, which said the war in Iraq is expected to be a two-stage operation with a pause to allow time for Saddam Hussein to be toppled by his own people. The Allied planning appears heavily weighted towards an incremental strategy that applies mounting pressure and allows time for Saddam's henchmen to decide their self-interest lies in risking a move against him. This is all about getting someone to tip him over, said the source, who's inside the British military command over in Kuwait. So the hope was that the build-up to war would provoke a military coup. The time came when, for reasons of political credibility, the bombing actually had to start. And so the ultimatum was issued hoping that that would provoke a military coup. The way the bombing actually started was in fits and starts to give top military commanders in Iraq the chance to stage a military coup. There are reports coming out now that the British and US forces may not take the Iraqi troops as prisoners of war, but may use them in some new military force in Iraq as a constabulary force to keep the peace against their own people. And my characterization of that is that in many ways this is a rerun of 1991. I think we are going to see yet again a betrayal of the Iraqi people. Last time what happened was that when the Iraqi people rose up to try and get some freedom, the United States effectively helped Iraq, but it was tacit and discreet by allowing helicopter gunships to fly, by blocking the rebels from getting access to Iraqi arms, which they were holding in bases which the U.S. forces had captured, and so on. Last time it was discreet and sort of tacit, but this time it's quite possible that if there is some kind of uprising, then the Iraqi armed forces will be used by U.S. forces in a more overt and perhaps even directive fashion to maintain the kind of political stability which Turkey and Saudi Arabia are interested in their populous and rich neighbor.
Milan Rai, that uprising that you're talking about began in the south of Iraq, the uprising following the so-called Gulf War in 1991. Let's talk about the situation in the south right now, where we're hearing these senior British commanders essentially expressing a kind of shock and stun about what they've seen in the south of Iraq in terms of Iraqi resistance. What's your read on what's been happening down there?
Well, I think that there are some reports coming out that people in the south are still very much in the grip of fear and saying things like, I've seen some reports this morning that saying things like, Saddam's people, if they come back into power in a year's time or 10 years' time or however long, we will suffer for whatever we do now. And I suspect that may be part of the picture. There are also Iraqi exiles who are saying that the United States and Britain have discounted all the way through the power of Iraqi nationalism. And I think, we just heard in the report from Iraq how that is affecting some people. So I think the picture is pretty unclear. I think that the US-UK strategy has been to try and win the war without really damaging very much of Iraq, and with the least possible use of military force, by basically terrifying the military commanders into overthrowing Saddam Hussein, installing a friendlier face, someone who is more obedient. And so they have tried to bypass all these population centers. I think the last thing they want to do is go street to street, but that may be the final logic. They took a gamble with this war. One of the elements of this gamble was that it would be short and very obviously successful, and that there wouldn't be a humanitarian disaster. Another gamble was that they wouldn't have to go into the cities. No one knew when they initiated the actual military action whether those gambles would pay off. But if those gambles don't pay off, then very large numbers of civilians in Iraq may pay the price.
We're talking to Milan Rai in London. He is author of War Plan Iraq, a book that's published by Verso Press, a long-time anti-war activist and writer, has been to Iraq a number of times. In your book, War Plan Iraq, you talk about Washington's hidden role in the collapse of the first UN weapons inspection agency, UNSCOM, and the paralysis of its successor, UNMAVIC. Can you lay that out?
Well, the first UN weapons inspectorate, UNSCOM, which dealt with the chemical and biological weapons in Iraq, came to an end in December 1998. And to cut a long story short, I think it's really summed up in the memoirs, a little bit from the memoirs of Richard Butler, who was the head of UNSCOM at the time. He recorded in his memoirs the way that UNSCOM came to an end, which was that he was called in by the U.S. ambassador to the UN, Peter Burley, who told him to take precautionary measures, and then Richard Butler said he would act on this advice, and he went straight to his office and evacuated UNSCOM. And that is how the UN weapons inspectors left last time. They were kicked out of Iraq, but they weren't kicked out by Baghdad, they were kicked out by Washington. And that was to create the political conditions of crisis that would seem to justify the military action which the US and UK took. And it's worth noting that that military action, Operation Desert Fox, was launched as the Security Council was sitting down to discuss and consider Richard Butler's report on the state of inspections and disarmament process.
Now, I want to go back for a minute, Milan, because you just said that was scuttled by Washington.
Yes.
Now, this is one of the most repeated stories by the Bush administration about how Saddam Hussein threw the weapons inspectors out in 1998.
Yes, and it's been repeated a lot over here, and Tony Blair was tackled on a BBC program over here, and at first he said that they were thrown out, and under repeated questioning, he ended up saying they were withdrawn because they weren't able to do their work properly. So in the end, he admitted that they had been withdrawn by the United States and Britain. But yes, this has been a major propaganda weapon in sort of demonizing Iraq. But it's just not true, and all you have to do is look at Richard Butler's memoirs. There's various editions of them, but over here I've got an edition called Saddam Defiant. He says very clearly that he had put in a report to the Security Council. He was called in by the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. He was basically instructed to get out of Iraq, and he went ahead and did it. And that's how the inspectorate came to an end in December 1998.
And Milan, what about the work of UNMAVIC and how it ultimately came to an end at the Security Council?
Well, in my hand right now, I've got a document which should have prevented the war, which was the UNMAVIC draft work program. Now, Britain, with U.S. backing, put in a resolution in December 1999, Resolution 1284, which said that when the inspectors go back to Iraq, after a preliminary period of getting their work going again, they should put in to the Security Council a list of recommended key remaining disarmament tasks which Iraq had to complete in order to show that it had disarmed. And it said what Iraq has to do for the completion of each task should be clearly defined and precise. And that finally happened on the 17th of March, and that's in this document which I've got right here. The US and UK have struggled to bury that process from happening because they didn't want clearly defined and precise disarmament tasks, because that would stop them from being able to keep moving the goalposts. Because every time Iraq complied on something, they said, aha, there's something else you've got to do. If we had a list of key disarmament tasks, that would be it, and they wouldn't be able to keep moving the goalposts. Secondly, if UNMAVIC had come to the Security Council and the Security Council had agreed the key remaining disarmament tasks, that would have started a new inspection and disarmament process in Iraq. And that's the last thing the U.S. wanted. It wanted not to start inspections in Iraq, but to finish them, get them out of the way, as in December 1998. So what happened was that the inspectors have not said that they were, their work had become impossible or that it was no use. And that therefore the inspection process, had no more value. They've never said that. Every report they've given something of a mixed picture about what their progress, But there has always been some progress in the inspection reports which they've been giving to the Security Council. The inspection, so the very day that they handed in the key remaining disarmament tasks to the Security Council for the Security Council to consider and possibly approve, they were ordered out of Iraq by President Bush, and that's how the inspection process came to an end this time.
We're talking to Milan Rai, who is author of War Plan Iraq. We are also joined by Christopher Simpson, who's a professor of communications at American University and author of several books, including Science of Coercion. I'm looking at an article, most recent piece by Agence France-Presse, headlined Propaganda One of the Biggest Weapons for Both Sides in Iraq War. It says, as the ground and air war plays out in Iraq, another battle just as crucial is taking place, the propaganda struggle between the British-U.S. coalition and Baghdad. The article goes on to say the most high-profile pawns in the psychological campaign have been the prisoners of war, the hundreds of Iraqis said to have surrendered in the south, and more dramatically, five U.S. soldiers captured on the weekend and shown alongside Arab broadcasts of dead comrades. The apparent downing of at least one U.S. Apache helicopter Monday added to the shock being felt in the U.S. and Britain. But other developments, either reported in the news or asserted by officials on both sides, have sought to exploit the situation and turn it to their advantage. Thus, U.S. authorities claim to have located a suspected chemical weapons plant as their forces drove on towards Baghdad, raised doubts over the health and command of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. In return, Iraqi officials have accused the Anglo-American coalition of war crimes and of suffering losses against fierce resistance mounted by their troops, militias, and even ordinary peasants. Washington and London have insisted that their advance is going well and they're on track to start the siege of Baghdad. Well, Chris Simpson and Milan Rai will talk about the psyops of psychological operations. I wanted to ask first about, well, there's a Washington Post front page picture on Sunday, and it is a picture, it says under it, surrender at Nasiriyah. An Iraqi soldier is blindfolded by soldiers from the Army's 3rd Infantry Division after surrendering at a town northwest of Basra. And a very clear picture of a man who is blindfolded and being held by U.S. troops. And I wanted to ask Chris Simpson how that picture compares to the pictures of the POWs that the Iraqi military now has, that people like Donald Rumsfeld have said just showing them on camera is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. What about this picture of the Iraqi man?
Well, it's in substance the same as what Rumsfeld and Bush are criticizing the Iraqis for doing. President Bush is right when he says that exploiting prisoners for propaganda or deliberately humiliating them in public, that type of thing, is a violation of the Geneva Convention. The Washington Post printed that story front page above the fold on Monday, that this is a violation of the Geneva Convention, and if, as though you hadn't heard it clearly enough on the front page, they published a similar story on the front page of their special section on the war. The day before, as you've just pointed out, the Post itself published a large color front page story about the capture of an Iraqi prisoner. My feeling about this is that you really can't have it both ways. What I think is most disturbing about this is that obvious hypocrisy, that obvious contradiction on literally the front page of the newspaper, seemed to sail right past all the pundits and the intellectuals and the so-called experts who are commenting on this war. To the best of my knowledge, nobody has brought it up before this program.
We are going to break for stations to identify themselves. Chris Simpson is our guest on the telephone from Washington at American University, among his books, Science of Coercion. And Milan Rai is with us from London. He is author of War Plan Iraq. At the end of the program, we're going to Madrid, where massive protest has been expressing itself over the last few weeks, with polls showing somewhere around 85% to 90% of the population is opposed to the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq. We'll be back in a minute.
Mother got a student suicide swing. Oh my, oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a student genocide swing. Oh my, oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a student suicide swing. Oh my, oh my God. Oh my God. Slam, bam, I come on the scene, but like gasoline, you can tell I'm in the tank, like money in the bank. I smell appealing, but I'm toxic, can send you reeling without an inkling. Keep you thinking, cause you gave cash to the feds, left your school district for dead. You up in the head, but still they saying nothing's wrong. Selling firewater by outlawing the bong. Still believing the system is working, while half of my people are still out of working. Anonymous notes left in the pockets and coats of judges and jurors from Frisco to Jersey. Threats and protests, politicians, mob debts, trumped up charges and phony arrests. Staged a lethal injection the night before the election, cause he got donation from the Prison Guards Union. Oh my, oh my God.
Michael Franti, oh my God, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. Michael will be joining us live in a Firehouse studio on Thursday. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. The International Committee of the Red Cross is calling on all sides to respect the Geneva Conventions after TV networks on Sunday began showing footage of U.S. prisoners of war in Iraq. Al Jazeera reports the neutral organization has come under criticism for not issuing a similar declaration when pictures of Iraqi detainees appeared on Saturday. ICRC spokesperson Florian Westfall rejected accusations of bias on the part of the ICRC, countering that huge media interest had prompted Sunday's response. He said, after the images of the American POWs were shown on Al Jazeera, the Arab news network, we were flooded with phone calls from the media, whereas on Saturday, when the images were shown of the Iraqi POWs, we hardly received any calls. He added, I think that may have led to the somewhat misleading impression that the ICRC had a lot to say about one case and not so much about the other. Although the ICRC is often asked to comment on political issues, the organization categorically refuses to take sides and strives to maintain a strictly neutral stance in order to ensure it can work freely during times of conflict. He said, we're not there to assess the behavior of one side or the other or to make judgments as to who may be more in the wrong than the other. Well, Christopher Simpson, your response.
I think that they're on target. If this had been going on for months and months, and the ICRC had ignored the publicity concerning the Iraqi prisoners, I think that there would be more grounds to criticize them. But what we're talking about is a relatively short period. Now, it is true that pictures of Iraqi prisoners are almost institutional in the West. In the sense that there were hundreds, probably thousands of them during the first Gulf War and already a number during this war. For my own 2 cents worth, if the ICRC comes out and makes a clear public statement about abuses of prisoners, then I'm for it. I think that's the right thing for them to do.
Chris Simpson, let's focus in on another area that you've spent a lot of time looking at, and that's the area of psychological operations. The United States, of course, for months now, since last October, very heavily, has been dropping millions of leaflets, particularly in the south of Iraq, from planes, also broadcasting radio into Iraq, emailing, spamming. I know when I was in Baghdad that you would get these spams constantly from the United States urging generals not to fight. Also, we understand that they were calling U.S. Air Force commanders on their telephones as well. Talk about the PSYOPs component of this war against Iraq.
Psychological operations, that term is used in different ways by different people, and so it can be confusing sometimes. The operations that you were just referring to are all communication-type operations. They're essentially propaganda in one form or another. PSYOPs in the sense that, for example, the CIA or the Green Beret use the term, are considerably more violent and involve assassinations, kidnapping, sabotage, guerrilla warfare of one sort or another, and so on. It's much more deadly. We have a clear statement of what PSYOPs means in that sense from the Iran-Contra war, where a CIA contractor was hired to put together a PSYOPs manual that was eventually distributed to the Contras. Those are the anti-Nicaraguan, anti-Sandinista forces that had been sponsored by the U.S. And their PSYOPs manual was quite explicit. It's go into a village and kill the mayor and kill school teachers and kill nurses. And why? Well, it's because those people were regarded as either being sympathetic to the government in Managua, the revolutionary government in Managua, or even if they weren't sympathetic, they were symbols of some sort of progress. And by murdering them, this tended to strengthen the Contras' hand. So that's what, you know, what real PSYOPs are. This sort of propaganda operation it's pretty much routine. I do think that the media, the mainstream media has really distorted how these things work, and the most basic distortion is the idea that they're aimed primarily at Iraqis. This is a misunderstanding. Those operations are aimed primarily at public opinion in the United States and outside of Iraq. And, if you wish, I can explain how that works.
I actually wanted to move on to another issue that has to do with not just the war abroad and psychological operations abroad, but right here at home. Referring back to a piece in the Washington Post yesterday that says, since the September 11th attacks, the Justice Department and FBI have dramatically increased the use of two little-known powers that allow authorities to tap telephones, seize bank and telephone records, and obtain other information in counterterrorism investigations with no immediate court oversight, according to officials and newly disclosed documents. The FBI, for example, has issued scores of national security letters that require businesses to turn over electronic records about finances, telephone calls, email, and other personal information. The letters, a type of administrative subpoena, may be issued independently by FBI field offices and are not subject to judicial review unless a case comes to court. Ashcroft, the attorney general, has also personally signed more than 170, quote, emergency foreign intelligence warrants, three times the number authorized in the preceding 23 years. And it goes on to say that federal law allows the attorney general to issue unilaterally these classified warrants for wiretaps and physical searches of suspected terrorists and other national security threats. Under certain circumstances, they can be enforced for 72 hours before they're subject to review and approval by the ultra-secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Chris Simpson, this is one of your specialties. Can you comment on the stepping up of secret surveillance here at home?
I think many people have been aware that this type of surveillance has been going on, that it has significantly increased since 9/11. And in fact, on a certain level, the Department of Justice has boasted about the increase of this type of surveillance. Having said that, the forcing these records, this small amount of accountability, this little bit of the picture into the public domain, I think is a good thing and a step forward, because it for the first time gives some reasonably authoritative picture of what's going on. It's not the whole picture. Two things that jump out right away is the claim that the Attorney General's national security, the foreign intelligence letters, and those sorts of things are reviewed by the FISA court. Well, in an administrative sense, that's true. But as a practical matter, the court, it's been in business almost 25 years now, has never once, not on a single occasion, rejected an attorney general's effort to get this type of information or in any way obstructed or even really seriously questioned what the Department of Justice is up to. Now, there was an incident last summer in which the FISA court actually barred a particular FBI agent from testifying in favor of these types of warrants because they concluded that he'd been lying to them for the previous 2 or 3 years. And that eventually became public. And what happened in the wake of that, in turn, is that there's an appeals procedure within this secret court system. And the FBI and the Department of Justice took it up to this next level in this secret court system, which promptly overturned what the main FISA court had ruled in that one case. So the machinery of this type of surveillance is well oiled, and it would be a mistake to expect much restraint coming out of FISA on the things that the Department of Justice or the FBI are doing.
We have also heard in the last month about, for example, Delta Airlines at 3 undisclosed airports increasing, setting up the terror coding of passengers, that we will all have an encrypted message in the ticket that would involve green means that you will not be investigated. Yellow means that you will be investigated, and this is based on database mining from bank records, credit ratings, and red won't fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and I think that's a very serious matter. Anybody who's dealt with credit agencies and had wrong credit reports published about them knows exactly how easy it is to end up in the wrong category and how difficult it is to get out of it. I'll give you just a personal example. I have a credit card, and one particular Christmas, I flew and had Christmas with my mother. And, the credit agency, literally within hours, suddenly discovered that I had charge some holiday presents in a different city from where I lived. And on that basis alone, canceled my credit card. And by that same afternoon, I was sitting in some bookstore trying to charge some books and was turned out. So when I called them up and made a big issue out of it, they acknowledged that this whole thing had been computerized. There was no human presence in it at all. And that on that basis alone, I was supposed this card was considered stolen. Now, how many people travel to during the holidays, right? I mean, lots of people do. So this is how the extent of blundering that this type of approach can lead to. I'll give you another example of this.
Chris, we just have 30 seconds.
Okay, well... Then let's go on to a different thing. On the psychological operations, simply count up how many Iraqis could possibly have seen leaflets or possibly do anything about leaflets compared to how many people in the West have seen repeated, even continuous stories about these leaflets. The airdrops of leaflets are aimed as much at Western audiences as they are at Iraqi audiences.
Well, Christopher Simpson, I want to thank you very much for being with us, professor of communications at American University, author of several books, including Science of coercion. As we move now to Madrid, Spain, massive protest is taking place throughout that country against the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The Guardian of London reported more than 500,000 people marched against war in Barcelona on Saturday. More protests expected after recent revelations that reports that U.S. B-52 bombers refueled over Spanish cities last week on their way to bomb Iraq. We're joined by former Democracy Now! Producer Maria Carrion in Madrid. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Maria.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. So can you explain what happened with these U.S. B-52 bombers?
Well, the El País, which is Spain's major newspaper, has conducted an investigation that has revealed that 13 B-52s last Friday, which was the day of the major bombing in downtown Baghdad, refueled over Barcelona, Bilbao, and Pamplona. Now, Barcelona has over 5 million inhabitants. It's a hugely densely populated area. And these are operations that are usually done over the sea or over unpopulated areas because they're extremely risky. Now people are up in arms because Spain said it would only provide humanitarian aid, as a military contribution. But, of course, this is going in a different direction and it's putting the population at risk. What happens usually is these planes have to come to within 30 feet of the refueling plane, these B-52s. And they could have either refueled in the Atlantic before they got to Spain, or they could have refueled in the Mediterranean after they left Spanish soil. France refused airspace, and that's why they flew over Spain. But they ran out of fuel almost immediately after takeoff because they were flying light of fuel because they wanted to carry as much weight in bombs as possible. So it wasn't possible to get to the Mediterranean. And in the Atlantic, they would have lost 2 hours just trying to refuel. So they did the most convenient thing, which was to fly, to enter Spain through northern Spain, through Bilbao, and begin the operation as they flew over Spain and exited out of the Barcelona coast.
1966 example of a crash.
Yeah, in 1966, a lot of people still remember this. A B-52 collided, and it was carrying thermonuclear bombs, collided with a refueling plane. They were coming from North Carolina. One of those bombs had 75 times more power than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. And it fell in a little town called Palomares in Almeria in southern Spain. At the time, it was the time of the dictatorship here. We had Franco's regime. And his minister, Manuel Fraga, who's still in the government now in Spain, actually took a very publicized dip in the ocean right next to where the bomb had fallen to prove that there was no danger. But, of course, the bomb's outer casing had burned off. And for the past 35 years, that area has been considered extremely contaminated. To this day, the Spanish nuclear agency is saying, please do not inhabit this area, nor cultivate any food there because it's very contaminated.
Maria, we only have 15 seconds. The level of protest right now in Spain as the Prime Minister Aznar continues to support Bush and Blair?
Enormous. I mean, we had protests every day since last Thursday. Enormous ones planned on Wednesday. A lot of police brutality, unlike in February when we didn't see one cop. Now, each demonstration, you see riot gear everywhere, and there's been a tremendous amount of injuries. But people are still very energized, and we will be seeing a lot of protests in the coming days.
Maria Carrion, thank you very much for joining us from Madrid, Spain. And that does it for this hour. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Noah Reibel. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website, democracynow.org. You can get a copy of the show by calling 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
They persuaded themselves that this Hollywood scenario of GIs driving through the streets of Iraqi cities being showered with roses by a relieved populace who desperately want the democracy which Mr. Bush has put on offer was a reality. And the truth of the matter is that Iraq has a very, very strong political tradition of anti-colonial struggle. There are many people in this country who would like to get rid of Saddam Hussein, I'm sure, but they don't want to live under American occupation.
Today, we will spend much of the hour with British reporter Robert Fisk on the ground in Baghdad, and then we'll hear from you, our listeners and viewers, on what you're doing in this time of war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report of Democracy Now! Unembedded radio and television. I'm Amy Goodman. About 500 Iraqi soldiers have been killed in the last 2 days by the 3rd Infantry Division's tanks and mechanized units as they sweep through southern Iraq. A massive sandstorm in Iraq has slowed the advance of U.S. and British troops towards Baghdad. High winds are keeping helicopter flights to a minimum. U.S. warplanes continue to bomb the Iraqi Republican Guard along the southern outskirts of the city. A U.S. helicopter was shot down, and shortly afterwards, Iraqi state television showed the two crewmen of a downed Apache helicopter. The Pentagon has identified the crewmen as 26-year-old Ronald Young Jr., 30-year-old David Williams. The airmen were the second set of POWs displayed by the Iraqis. Troops from the U.S. Army 5th Corps have formed a front line about 50 miles south of Baghdad. Vast convoys of tanks and ground forces are racing up from Kuwait to join them. Retired U.S. Army General Barry McCaffrey, a commander in the 1991 Gulf War, told the BBC the battle for Baghdad could be brutal and result in as many as 3,000 coalition casualties. He also said War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has misjudged the nature of the conflict by not sending in more troops to take the Iraqi capital. After the first Gulf War, Seymour Hersh, the investigative reporter at The New Yorker, reported that McCaffrey ordered the bombing of Iraqi forces retreating from Kuwait. An Australian pilot has refused a U.S. command to bomb a target in Iraq. Australian military spokesman Brigadier Mike Hannon said the crew chose not to complete the mission because they could not positively identify the target. He said the crew's decision reflects the Australian military's, quote, strong commitment to the laws of armed conflict. Canberra has emphasized that its forces will refuse to attack civilian targets, including key bridges, dams, and other vital infrastructure of the kind bombed by the United States during the 1991 Gulf War. U.S. officials told CNN intelligence reports suggest that Republican Guard units might have been ordered to use chemical weapons against U.S. forces if they cross a, quote, red line drawn around Baghdad. It is still extremely difficult to get information on Iraqi casualties. The London Guardian is reporting in Nasiriyah, a U.S. warplane dropped up to 4 cluster bombs on a civilian area, killing 10 and wounding 200. In northeast Iraq, U.S. missiles hit a village, killing 34 people. And Kurdish officials say at least 150 people were killed by U.S. bombing over the weekend in northern Iraq. The BBC has just reported bodies of at least 30 Iraqis have been seen along the road from the southern town of Nasiriyah, and 39 U.S. and British military personnel have been confirmed killed since the U.S. invasion of Iraq began. Meanwhile, in the south, the BBC reports several thousand U.S. troops are advancing through the town of Nasiriyah after protracted clashes with Iraqi forces. British commanders have declared Basra a, quote, legitimate military target after encountering unexpectedly stiff resistance. According to coalition military sources, Iraqi forces that were defending areas south of Basra have pulled back into the town. The International Committee of the Red Cross is warning of an impending humanitarian disaster in Basra. The city has been without water and electricity since Friday. And a British commander has declared the southern Iraqi port town of Umm Qasr, quote, safe and open. A British army spokesperson said aid shipments through the port city could begin today. The London Guardian and Al Jazeera are reporting that the U.S. is quickly losing the battle for the hearts and minds as civilian casualties increase and humanitarian aid is slow to arrive. One local resident told The Guardian, "We were happy when the U.S. promised to get rid of Saddam Hussein and his regime, but this is replacing Saddam with another form of tyranny." The Arab language news agency Al Jazeera has launched an English language version of its website. The website bills itself as objective and balanced global news coverage and analysis and offers a different view of the war than Western media outlets. Stocks plunged yesterday and the Dow Jones Index fell by over 300 points in its worst day since September. This follows the best week the Dow had in over 20 years when it appeared the coalition forces would achieve a lightning victory in Iraq. The massive sell-off came as the Washington Post, London Guardian, and other papers began reporting Iraq may become a quagmire for Americans. Meanwhile, a new Washington Post ABC News poll has found over half the country believes coalition forces will sustain significant casualties in the war, and nearly half expect the war to last months rather than days or weeks. Both figures are up nearly 40% from Thursday. Despite all of this, U.S. Commander General Tommy Franks last night insisted coalition forces are making, quote, rapid and in some cases dramatic progress. President Bush has asked Congress for $75 billion to pay for the invasion of Iraq. The money covers expenses only for the next 6 months. $8 billion is earmarked for international aid, relief, and reconstruction of Iraq. A U.S. presidential envoy arrived in Turkey on Monday to press Turkey to refrain from sending troops across the border. But Turkey claims the troops are needed to deter a possible Kurdish uprising in the north. Syria has launched a protest with the U.S. and Britain after U.S. missiles struck a Syrian passenger bus carrying 37 civilians. Five people were killed, 10 injured in the attack. Iran's deputy interior minister has said Iran reserves the right to fire on coalition aircraft in its airspace if they fail to heed a warning to leave. Meanwhile, several hundred British soldiers have been dropped along the Iran-Iraqi border in the south. An explosion damaged part of the British Council building in Beirut in the early hours of this morning. A bomb has also been thrown at Britain's honorary consulate in a port city in Ecuador. In India, authorities say half a dozen armed rebels bombed a warehouse in the south of the country, razing it to the ground. The warehouse was stocked with Pepsi bottles. And Human Rights Watch has charged Monday that Egyptian anti-war protesters are being subjected to torture. The New York-based human rights group also said hundreds of demonstrators have been injured in brutal police crackdowns. In San Francisco, more than 100 people were arrested in another day of anti-war protests. And in Germany, anti-war demonstrators and police clashed outside the United States consulate in Hamburg. Police rallies or peace rallies emptied schools across Italy on Monday. And Harry Fisher died this weekend. He fought in the Spanish Civil War against Franco and the rise of fascism. On Saturday, as he was marching against the U.S. invasion of Iraq, he had a heart attack. He was 92 years old.
Voices roar. Stop the war. Just like thunder, y'all. Don't put it on.
Stop the War. Edwin Starr here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Jeremy Scahill, just back from Baghdad.
Well, we're getting now reports that these U.S. forces are making their way to Baghdad, and they haven't secured the south of Iraq yet. I'm very curious as to what the strategy is here, because it seems almost as though they're now fleeing this area in the south, essentially leaving the Brits there. They've now moved up to Baghdad, and people have to remember Baghdad is a city of 5 million people. It's a sprawling type of city like Los Angeles, and it has very, very crowded areas, high-rise buildings. It's going to be very difficult for U.S. forces to come in and secure that city.
Well, Jeremy, we're going to go to Baghdad right now. I'm reading from Robert Fisk's piece, Iraq Will Become a Quagmire for the Americans. Robert Fisk, the London Independent reporter who has been voted best foreign correspondent by editors and reporters in Britain for many years, usually based in Beirut for the last 30 years. Now, right now, in Baghdad, no surprise. He's a veteran war correspondent, and his latest piece begins, Iraq stunned the Americans and British last night by broadcasting videotape of captured and dead American troops, the nightmare of both George Bush and Tony Blair. The body of one American soldier was seen with a great red gash on his neck, while five U.S. prisoners appeared on screen. One, a black female soldier, had been wounded while a male serviceman said he'd been only following orders. The film will increase internal support for Saddam Hussein because it will be regarded as proof that the American-British force will be beaten. And he goes on from there. Well, late last night, Jeremy and I got in touch with Robert Fisk in Baghdad. We woke him up, but then he spent the next 40 minutes with us. We started by just asking him what it was like in Baghdad.
Well, it's been a relatively quiet night. There's been quite a lot of explosions about an hour ago, where there were obviously quite a lot of missiles arriving on some target. But I would say it was 4 or 5 miles away. You can hear the change of air pressure, and you hear this long, low rumble like drums, like somebody banging on a drum deep beneath the ground, but quite a way away. There have only been 2 or 3 explosions near the center of the city, which is where I am, in the last 12 hours. So I suppose you could say that comparatively, for anyone living in central Baghdad, it's been a quiet night. But the strange thing is that the intensity of the attacks on Baghdad changes quite extraordinarily. You'll get one evening when you can actually sleep through it, or the next evening when you see the explosions red hot around you, as if no one's really planning the thing, as if people wake up in the morning and say, well, let's target this on the map today. Something which seems to characterize the whole adventure, because if you actually look at what's happening on the ground, you'll see that the American and British armies started off from the border, tried to go to Umkasa, got stuck, carried on up the road through the desert, took another right turn, tried to get into Basra, got stuck, took another right at Nasiriyah, got stuck. It's as if they keep on saying, well, let's try the next road to the right. It has a kind of lack of planning to it. Now, there'll be those who say that, no, it's all meticulously planned, but it doesn't feel like it to be here.
Can you talk about the POWs and television, the charge that they are violating the Geneva Convention by showing them on television?
Well, you know, the Geneva Convention is meant to protect children, and the hospitals are full of civilians, including many children who have been badly wounded. It seems to me that this concentration on whether television should show prisoners or not is a kind of mischief. It's not the point. The issue, of course, is that both sides are taking prisoners and that both sides want the other side to know the prisoners they've taken. I watched CNN showing a British soldier forcing a man to kneel on the ground and put his hands up and produce his identity card. I've seen other film on British television of prisoners near Umkasa and Basra being forced to march past a British soldier with their hands in the air. Well, they weren't interviewed, it's true, although you heard at one point a man asking questions. Clearly, to put any prisoner on air and ask them questions on air is against the Geneva Convention. But for many, many years now in the Middle East, television has been showing both sides in various wars, appearing on television and being asked what their names and their home countries are. The real issue is that these prisoners should not, of course, be maltreated, tortured, hurt after capture. When you realize that 19 men have tried to commit suicide at Guantanamo, that we now know that two prisoners at the U.S. base at Bagram were beaten to death during interrogation, to accuse the Iraqis of breaking the Geneva Conventions by putting American POWs on television, in which you hear them being asked what state they come from in the States and so on, it seems a very hypocritical thing to do. But one would have to say that technically, putting a prisoner of war on television and asking them questions on television is against the Geneva Convention. It is quite specifically so. And thus, clearly, Iraq broke that convention when it put those men on television. I watched them on Iraqi TV here. But as I say, it's a pretty hypocritical thing when you realize the disgraceful way in which America treats prisoners from Afghanistan. Mr. Bush is not the person to be teaching anyone about the Geneva Convention.
Robert Fisk, you wrote in one of your most recent articles, actually the title of it was Iraq Will Become a Quagmire for the Americans. And I think many people within the U.S. administration were surprised to find the kind of resistance that they have in places like Nasiriyah. We have the two Apache helicopters that apparently have been shot down, many, many U.S. Casualties so far. Do you think that the Americans were caught by surprise, particularly by the resistance in the South, where everyone was saying the people are against Saddam Hussein?
Well, they shouldn't have been caught by surprise. There were plenty of us writing that this was going to be a disaster and a catastrophe and that they were going to take casualties. You know, one thing that I think the Bush administration has shown as a characteristic is that it dreams up moral ideas and then believes that they're all true and characterizes this policy by assuming that everyone else will then play their roles. In their attempt to dream up an excuse to invade Iraq, they started off, remember, by saying that, first of all, that there were weapons of mass destruction. We were then told that Al-Qaeda had links to Iraq, all of which certainly there isn't an Al-Qaeda link. We were told there were links to September 11th, which was rubbish. And in the end, the best the Bush administration could do was to say, well, we're going to liberate the people of Iraq. And because it provided this excuse, it obviously then had to believe that the people wanted to be liberated by the Americans. And as the Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz said a few hours ago, I was listening to him in person, the Americans expected to be greeted with roses and music, and they were greeted with bullets. And I think you see what's happened is that, and as he pointed out, you know, the Americans lectured the American administration and the U.S. press lectured everybody about how the country would break apart. There were Shiites hated Sunnis, and Sunnis hated Turkmens, and Turkmens hated Kurds, and so on. And yet most of the soldiers fighting in southern Iraq are actually Shiite. They're not Sunnis. They're not Tikritis. They're not from Saddam's home city. Saddam did not get knocked off his perch straight away. And I think that to a considerable degree, you see, the American administration allowed that little cabal of advisors around Bush, I'm talking about Pearl, Wolfowitz, and these other people, people who've never been to war, never served their country, never put on uniform, nor indeed, for that matter, has Mr. Bush ever served his country. They persuaded themselves that this Hollywood scenario of GIs driving through the streets of Iraqi cities being showered with roses by a relieved populace who desperately want the democracy which Mr. Bush has put on offer was a reality. And the truth of the matter is that Iraq has a very, very strong political tradition of anti-colonial struggle. It doesn't matter if that's carried out under the guise of a king, or under the guise of the Arab Socialist Baath Party, or under the guise of a total dictator. There are many people in this country who would like to get rid of Saddam Hussein, I'm sure, but they don't want to live under American occupation. And it's a bit like, I mean, the nearest I can describe it, and again, you know, things can change. Maybe the pack of cards will all collapse tomorrow. But if I can describe it, it would be a bit like the situation in 1941. And I hate these World War II parallels because I think it's disgusting to constantly dig up the Second World War. You know, Hitler is dead and he died in 1945 and we shouldn't use it. But if you want a faint parallel, you would look at Operation Barbarossa when the Germans invaded Russia. in 1941, believing that the Russians would collapse because Stalin was so hated, communism was so hated. And at the end of the day, the Russians preferred to fight the Germans to free their country from Germany, from Nazi rule, rather than use the German invasion to turn against Stalin. And at the end of the day, a population, many of whom had suffered greatly under communism, fought for their motherland under Stalin, under the leadership of Marshal Stalin, against the German invader. A similar situation occurred in 1980 when Saddam himself invaded Iran. There had just been less than 12 months earlier a revolution in Iran, and the Islamic Republic had come into being. And it was believed here in Baghdad that if an invasion force crossed the border from Iraq, supported in this case, of course, again by the Americans, that the Islamic Republic would fall to pieces, that it would collapse under its own volition, that it couldn't withstand a foreign invasion. And I actually crossed the border with the Iraqi forces in 1980. I was reporting on both sides. And I remember reaching the first Iranian city called Khorramshahr, and we came under tremendous fire, mortar fire, sniper fire, artillery fire. And me, I remember suddenly thinking, as I hid in this villa with a number of Iraqi army commandos, my goodness me, the Iranians are fighting for their country. And I think the same thing is happening now. And you see, obviously we know that with the firepower the Americans have, they can batter their way into these cities. They can take over Baghdad. But the moral ethos behind this war is that you Americans are supposed to be coming to liberate this place. And if you're going to have to smash your way into city after city with armor and helicopters and aircraft, then the whole underpinning of the purpose of this war disappears. And the world, that has not been convinced so far that this is a wrong war, an unjust war, is going to say, well, what is this for? We clearly aren't liberating these people. If we are, they don't want to be liberated by us. And that's when we're going to come down to the old word, oil. It's quite significant that in the next few hours, the oil minister in Iraq is supposed to be addressing the press, and that might turn out to be one of the more interesting press conferences that we've had, even more interesting, perhaps, than the various briefings from military officials about the course of the war.
We're speaking to Robert Fisk, a reporter for the Independent newspaper. He is in Baghdad right now. And if you'd like to get a transcript of today's program, you can just go to our website after the show at www.democracynow.org. We're also live streaming audio and video. And you are listening to us on Pacifica Radio, Pacifica affiliate stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, and the largest public media collaboration in this country. Back with Robert Fisk in a minute.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America.
Is it for freedom? Sarah Thompson here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. As we return to the conversation we had late last night with Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper in Baghdad, Iraq, I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill. Fisk in Baghdad, in Iraq. Robert, we also have word that the Turks have crossed over the border, Turkish soldiers, thousands of them, into northern Iraq.
I wouldn't be surprised. I really don't know. You've got to realize that although communications and electricity continues in Baghdad, I only know what I see on the radio and television, and as in all wars, covering it is an immensely exhausting experience. I simply haven't been able to keep up with what's happening in the north. I rely on people like you, Amy, to tell me. I've got a pretty good idea what's happening in the rest of Europe, but the north I haven't.
Well, can you tell us what's happening and what it's like to report there? How are you getting around? And do you agree with what the Iraqi general that you quoted, Rawi, is saying about Iraq will become a quagmire for the Americans?
Well, it's not just Rawi. We've had Vice President Ramadan. We've had the Minister of Defense just over 24 hours ago giving the most detailed briefings. I mean, one of the interesting things is that whether or not you believe these various briefings are correct, the detail is quite extraordinary. And certainly we're being given more information about what's going on at the front, accurate or not, than most of the Western correspondents are getting in Qatar. I mean, you will see, you know, pictures of journalists saying, well, I'm with the U.S. Marines and I'm not far from a town which I can't name, but we're having some problems there. Well, this is Nasiriyah and here's the bridge. If you go to the Iraqi briefings, they'll tell you it's the 3rd Corps, 45th Battalion, 3rd. They're actually giving the names of officers who are in charge of various units and what positions they're in and where the battles are taking place. There is actually more detail being given out by the Iraqis than there is by Americans or the British, which is quite remarkable. It's the first time I've ever known this. Now, again, it may be a little over plausible to think that all this information is accurate. When the Iraqis first said they'd taken American prisoners, we said, oh, more propaganda. Then up comes the film of the prisoners. Then they said they'd shot down a helicopter. And the journalists in the briefing here all looked at each other and said, well, there's another story. And suddenly we see film of shot down helicopter. And then another film of shot down helicopter. They said they'd attacked and destroyed armored personnel carriers belonging to the U.S. Armed Forces. And we all looked at each other and said, here we go again, more propaganda. And then we see film on CNN of burning APCs. So there's a good deal of credibility now being given to the Iraqi version of events, although I'd have to say that their total version of how many aircraft have been shot down appears to be an exaggeration. So we do have, in that sense, a moderately good idea of what's actually happening. There are Iraqis moving around inside Iraq, arriving in Baghdad, and giving us accounts of events which appear to be the same as the accounts given by various authorities. No journalist can leave Baghdad to go to the south to check this out for himself, although I suspect that will happen in due course. I think they probably will get journalists to move around, providing they can, you know, produce a scenario which is favorable to Iraq. But frankly, at the moment, any scene that a journalist sees of opposition to the United States would be favorable to Iraq as far as they're concerned. But, you know, it may well be it may well be that with the Americans now only about 50 miles away from where I am, if they're going to try and enter Baghdad or the siege of Baghdad begins, and of course the Iraqis have boasted for a long time that this would be a kind of Stalingrad, here comes the World War II nonsense again, well, we won't have to go very far to see the Americans fighting the Iraqis. We'll see them with our own eyes. The Americans will be arriving close to Baghdad. They already are close. When we move around, you're asking about reporting, it's not nearly as claustrophobic as you might imagine. I mean, I can walk out of my hotel in the evening, and if I can find a restaurant open, there are one or two, I can get a cab and go out to dinner. Nobody stops me. When I'm traveling around during the day, if I want to go and carry out any interviews or I want to do any journalistic performance, I have a driver and I have what is called a minder, who is a person provided by the ministry to travel with me. Now, this means that nobody I talk to is going to be able to speak freely. I can't. I've gone up to people on the street, shopkeepers, and talked to them about the situation, but it's quite clear. They're well aware that there is a representative of the authorities with me. And I, in fact, don't do any interviews like that anymore. I think it's ridiculous. Many of my colleagues continue to point microphones at these poor people and ask them questions which they cannot possibly respond to freely. I simply don't do interview stories. There's no point in doing so because I think it's intimidating for the people one is talking to. It is unprofessional and unethical to travel with anyone else on an assignment of that kind. But, you know, as I say, I can get in the car and without a minder and go to the grocery shop and pick up, you know, groceries, bottles of water, bottled water, biscuits, vegetables. I don't need to travel around with a minder in that case, and nobody minds. In other words, it's not actually a sort of, it's not as if you're under great oppressive watch. Television reports now, by and large, when reporters are making television interviews, or when they're being, you know, being interviewed by their head offices, they now require a ministry minder to sit and listen. That does not mean they're being censored, but of course, in a sense, it must mean that they bite their lip occasionally. I will not do any television interviews with minders present, so I don't appear on television here. The odd thing is, though, that there's no control at all attempted over written journalism or radio journalism. I mean, I'm talking to you now, I'm sure this phone is listened to, but whether they have the capacity to listen to every phone call throughout Baghdad, I doubt very much. And I can say anything I want, and I do. And I write, if you read what I've been writing, you know, I'm not at all worried about being critical of the regime here, and I am. So it's really a television thing I think the authorities are more fixated with. And the actual presence of the minder, who in my case is a pleasant guy who does not have a political upbringing particularly, is more a concern, which I suppose one can understand if you see it in Iraqi eyes or the eyes of the regime, to make sure the reporter is not doing some kind of dual purpose. Obviously, there's a tradition that journalists have sometimes, unfortunately, turned out to work for governments as well as newspapers or television. And I think the concern of the Iraqis is firstly that some vital piece of information doesn't get out to what is now referred to by them as the enemy. And secondly, that reporters are what they say they are. But, you know, this happened in Yugoslavia during the Serbian War when I was in there from the beginning of the war, and most journalists were thrown out and I managed to hang on. And at the beginning, one couldn't travel anywhere in Serbia or Yugoslavia at all without a government official. And as the days and weeks went by and they realized you really were what you said you were, and you were not at all interested in working for anyone except your editor and your newspaper, a form of trust builds up where they know that you disapprove of their regime, but they equally know that you're going to tell the truth, even if it is critical towards you know, Britain or America or ever. And they leave you alone, and by and large, I mean, I've been to Iraq many times, and I know a lot of people here, both in authority and civilians and friends. I think people generally realize that The Independent, for example, really is an independent newspaper. So there's no great attempt, there's no attempt to influence me or to force me to praise the regime, for example, which is a sort of Hollywood version of what happens in these places. I've written very critically with condemnation of Saddam and the regime and all the human rights abuses here and the use of gas and Halabja and so on. I think there's a sort of understanding that as long as you're a real journalist, you will have to say these things. And indeed, one has to, one should. But that doesn't mean that we are laboring under the krill heel, to use Churchill's frame, of some kind of Gestapo. But again, this is not a free country. This is a dictatorship. This is a regime that does not believe in the free speech that you and I believe in.
Robert Fisk,
so one has to do one's best to get the story out.
Do you think Saddam Hussein is in control?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There have been a few incidents, which, I mean, there was quite a lot of shooting last night, and there were various rumors that people had come from Saddam City and there'd been a clash with security forces or security agents. Rumors of a railway line being blown up, which have been denied by the authorities. But there's no doubt Saddam is in control. I mean, it's very funny sitting here. It's like, in a strange way, I suppose, if you could listen to some of the things that were said about the United States here, you'd laugh in America. But, I mean, I've been listening to this uproariously funny argument about whether the Saddam speech was recorded before the war, whether it's really him, whether he has lookalikes. So that, in fact, the speech that Saddam made 24 hours ago, less than 24 hours ago, a speech that was very important if you actually read the text carefully and understand what he was trying to do, has been totally warped in the United States by a concentration not on what he was saying, but whether it was actually him that was saying it. An American correspondent was saying to me yesterday morning here, this is ridiculous, we simply can't report the story because every time we have to deal with something that Saddam says, the Pentagon claims it's not him or it's his double or that it was recorded 2 weeks ago. So the story ceases to be what the man says. The story starts to be this totally mythical, fictional idea that it isn't really Saddam or it's his double, etc. I mean, I watched this recording on television. All his television broadcasts are recordings because he's not so stupid as to do a live broadcast and get bombed by the Americans while he's doing it. The one thing you learn if you're a target, since you don't do live television broadcasts, or radio for that matter, or indeed telephone. But if you listened, read, and the text of what Saddam said, it had clearly been recorded in the previous few hours. And I can tell you, having once met the actual man, it definitely was Saddam Hussein. But that's the strange thing, you see, that in the United States, the Pentagon only has to say, it's not Saddam, it's a fake. It was recorded years ago, it's a double. And the Hollywood side of the story, which is rubbish, it's not true, it is him, then takes over from the real story, which is, what the hell is this guy actually saying?
What is he saying?
And what he was, there were several themes. The first one, 14 times he told the Iraqis, be patient, be patient, be patient. Oddly enough, that's what Joseph Stalin told the Russian people in 1941 and 1942, be patient. He made a point of specifically naming the army officers in charge of Umm Qasr, Basra, Nasiriyah, and the various other cities and small towns which are holding out against the Americans, which are holding up their forces. It was quite important that he actually was saying the army, the Ba'ath Party militia. He was constantly reiterating that these things were happening, that they were opposing the Americans were taking casualties. In some ways, his speech was not totally unlike that of George W. Bush. He talked about fighting evil, fighting the devil. Indeed, that's also what, although there's no connection with Saddam, that's one thing that bin Laden used to say a lot, isn't it? The idea that you're good versus evil has now become a sort of part of the patois of every warring leader, whether it be Bush or Saddam or anyone else. But there was also this constant reference to the anti-colonial history of Iraq, the need to remember that this was a battle against an invader, that these people were invading from another country. This was not Iraq invading the United States, but the United States invading Iraq. It was not a speech delivered with a good deal of passion, and Saddam is capable of emotion. He read from a text. It wasn't Churchillian. Again, here we go. World War II grasps even me like a ghost. But it was an interesting text because of its constant repetition, wait, we will win eventually. And it was quite clear what came over from it. Saddam believes that Iraq's salvation, or at least the salvation of the regime, shall we say, is in just keep on fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting until the moral foundations and underpinnings which America has attached to this invasion have collapsed. In other words, if you can keep holding on week after week, if you can suck the Americans into the quagmire of Baghdad and make them fight and use artillery against civilian areas, that will undermine the whole moral purpose that was strapped onto this war. And frankly, having listened to the various meretricious reasons put forward for this war, I think he's understood one of the main reasons why it's taking place, and thus has now decided that he's going to go on fighting. And of course, once you apply unconditional surrender, World War II, isn't that what Roosevelt did at Casablanca? There is no way out. There is no diplomatic. I mean, there was an interesting moment last night when Tariq Aziz was asked by a journalist, can you see a way out? Can you see a diplomatic result? Is it possible to have another peace? And Tariq Aziz looked at the journalist as if he'd seen a ghost. You know, he said, well, what are you talking about? There's a war. I actually asked Tariq Aziz, I said, look, you've given us a very dramatic description of the last 7 days of the war. Can you give us a dramatic description of the next 7 days? But he said, stay on here in Baghdad, he said, and you'll find out.
You are listening to Robert Fisk speaking to us from Baghdad, Iraq. An unembedded reporter with the Independent of Britain. We'll be back with this conversation in a minute.
masquerade. Yeah. Oh yeah. Are you really what we see on the outside? And hiding what you really are on the inside?
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill as we continue the conversation that we had with reporter Robert Fisk late last night in Baghdad, Iraq. Robert Fisk with the Independent Newspaper of Britain on the ground in Baghdad.
Robert Fisk, what are you seeing in terms of preparations for the defense of Baghdad? The people that we've been interviewing inside of Iraq, both ordinary Iraqis as well as journalists and others, are saying that there aren't really visible signs that there are any overt preparations underway. What's your sense?
Well, it doesn't look like Stalingrad to me, but then again, I suppose when Stalingrad began, there probably was a lot of preparations. There are certainly, I've been over 20 miles outside Baghdad, and you can certainly see troops building big artillery revetments around the city. I mean, positions for heavy artillery and mortars. Army vehicles hidden underneath overpasses. The barracks, the big barracks of long ago, as they were in Serbia before the NATO bombardment, been abandoned. Most of these cruise missiles that we hear exploding at night are bursting into government buildings, ministries, offices and barracks that have long ago been abandoned. There's nobody inside them. They're empty. I've watched ministries take all their computers out, trays, even the pictures from the office walls. That's the degree to which these buildings are empty. They're shells, which at, you know, $1 million a shot is pretty expensive, but there you go. Inside the city, there have been a lot of trenches dug beside roads, sandbag positions set up. In some cases, holes dug with sandbags around them to make positions on road intersections for snipers and machine gunners. This is pretty primitive stuff. I mean, it might be World War II in fabrication, but it doesn't look like the kind of defenses that are going to stop a modern mechanized army like that of the United States or Britain. I think America's a bit more modernized than we are. But you see, again, I don't think it needs to be, because whereas America's power is in its firepower, its mechanized state, its sophistication, its technology, Iraqi military power is in saying these people are invading us and we continue to resist them. The act of resistance is the principal element of Iraq's military defense, the act of resistance, not whether you can stop this tank or that tank. And the fact of the matter is, and it's obviously something that's been grasped in the Middle East over the years, the West doesn't want to take casualties. They don't want die. Now, nobody wants to die, but some people out here have realized that a new form of warfare is set in where the United States, if they want to invade a country or bombard it, they use other people's soldiers to do it. Look at the way in which the Israelis, for example, used Lebanese mercenaries of the South Lebanon Army in South Lebanon. Look at the way in which the Americans used the KLA in Kosovo or the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. But here in Iraq, there isn't anyone they can use. The Iraqi opposition appears to be hopeless. The Iraqis have not risen up against their oppressors as they did in 1991 when they were betrayed by the Americans and the British after being urged to fight Saddam. They're staying at home. They're letting the Americans do the liberating. If the Americans want to liberate them, fine, let the Americans do it. But the Americans aren't doing very well at the moment, and that, of course, is the problem. See, already we've got a situation down in Basra where the British Army have admitted firing artillery into the city of Basra and then whinging on afterwards saying, oh, well, we're being fired at from soldiers hiding among civilians. Well, I'm sorry, all soldiers defending cities are among civilians. But now the British are firing artillery shells into the heavily populated city of Basra. Now, when the British were fired on with mortars or snipers, from the Bogside in Derry in Northern Ireland, they did not use artillery on the Cregan estate or the Bogside. But here, apparently, it's okay to use artillery on a crowded city. What on earth is the British Army doing in Iraq firing artillery into a city after invading the country? Is this really about weapons of mass destruction? Is this about Al-Qaeda? I mean, it's interesting that in the last few days, not a single reporter has mentioned September the 11th. This is supposed to be about September the 11th. This is supposed to be about the war on terror, but nobody calls it anymore because deep down nobody believes it is. So what is it about? It's interesting, there are very few stories being written about oil. We're told about the oil fields being mined, booby-trapped, some oil wells set on fire. But oil is not really quite the point. Strange enough, in Iran, in Baghdad, you don't forget it, because in order, in an attempt to mislead the guidance system of the heat-seeking missiles and of cruise missiles, the Iraqis have set fire to berms of oil around the city, and all day, all you see is this sinister black canopy of oil smoke over Baghdad. It blots out the sun, it makes the wind rise, it gets quite cold. And here you can't forget the word oil, but I don't hear it very much in news reports.
We're talking to Robert Fisk in Baghdad. We're talking to Robert
You're
Fisk
You're talking to a very tired
Iraq.
Robert Fisk in Baghdad, who'd like to go back to sleep, Amy.
And we're going to let you go back to sleep. I wanted to get your comment, though, on Richard Perle's piece in The Guardian, where he said, Saddam Hussein's reign of terror is about to end. He will go quickly, but not alone. In a parting irony, he will take the UN down with him.
Well, poor old UN. Very soon, the Americans are going to need the United Nations as desperately as they wanted to get rid of them. Because if this turns into the tragedy that it is turning into at the moment, if the Americans end up by besieging Baghdad day after day after day, they'll be looking for a way out. And the only way out is going to be the United Nations, at which point, believe me, the French and the Russians are going to make sure that George Bush passes through some element of humiliation to do that. But that's some way away. Remember what I said earlier on to you, the Americans can do it. They have the firepower. They may need more than 250,000 troops, but if they're prepared to sacrifice lives of their own men as well as the lives of the Iraqis, they can take Baghdad. They can come in. But, you know, I look down from my balcony here next to the Tigris River. Does that mean we're going to have an American tank on every intersection in Baghdad? What are they there for? To occupy? To repress? To run an occupation force against the wishes of Iraqis? Or are they liberators? It's very interesting the way in which the reporting has swung from one side to the other. Are these liberating forces or occupying forces? Every time I hear a journalist say liberation, I know he means occupation. And we come back to the same point again, which Mr. Perle will not acknowledge. Because this war does not have a UN sanction behind it. I mean sanction not in the sense of sanctions, but permission. It is a war without international legitimacy. And the longer it goes on, the more it hurts Bush and the less it hurts Saddam. And we're now into 1 week. And there isn't a single American soldier even approached the city of Baghdad yet. As I say, the strange thing when you're here, and this is looking at it from this perspective in Baghdad, is the ad hoc way, excuse me, the ad hoc way in which this war appears to be carried out. We've heard about the air campaign. There is no campaign. There's not a single Iraqi airplane in the sky. This isn't the Luftwaffe versus the Battle of Britain or the Royal Air Force or the USAF. This is an air bombardment. The fighting is going on the ground. There wasn't meant to be any fighting, but there is. But it's the way in which on the first night there was some distant rumblings, and we were told, well, the war's begun, but it wasn't actually a bombardment of Baghdad. It was a one-off attempt to kill Saddam. As if someone walked into the White House and said, Mr. President, look, we're not planning to start till tomorrow, but we've got this opportunity of killing Saddam. Okay, let's have a go. Let's try it. Then we had this big blitz the following night, and a much bigger one the night afterwards, where, you know, literally I was standing in the street watching buildings blowing up all over Baghdad around me. A whole presidential palace went into flames right in front of me. Quite extraordinary. Anarchical sight of gold and red colors and tremendous explosions with the leaves dropping off the trees like autumn was, you know, in the spring. And then the next night, quite quiet. And last night, for example, most of the attacks by the cruise missiles were in the suburbs. And it was possible, until you rang, of course, to sleep. It's as if someone down there in Qatar or in CENTCOM in Tampa, Florida, or wherever, is saying, okay, well, let's send another 20 tonight. Let's send 300 tonight. Where should we send them? Oh, let's send them here. It's as if the whole idea of the war was not planned militarily. It was planned politically. It was planned ideologically, as if there's an ideological plan behind the war. It started with Al-Qaeda, it moved on to weapons of mass destruction, then we're going to liberate the people. And it's all going wrong. Whatever kind of ideological plan there was, it's falling to bits. Now, of course, maybe Saddam falls in the next few days. Maybe Baghdad collapses. I actually believed and wrote in the paper a few days ago that it's possible one morning we'll get up and all the militias and the Iraqi soldiers will have gone and we'll see American soldiers walking through the streets. But I don't believe that now.
Last question. Have you been to the hospitals of Baghdad?
Yes, quite a few of them. The main visit I made was to one of the main government hospitals on Saturday morning after a pretty long night of explosions around the city, in which, of course, quite a lot of these cruise missiles exploded on their targets. Others missed them and crashed into civilian areas. I went to one hospital where there were, I spoke, the doctors here are not Ba'ath Party members. Indeed, the doctor, chief doctor I spoke to actually was trained in Edinburgh, where he got his FRCS, and he went very coldly down the list of patients. He had 101, whom he estimated 16 were soldiers, 85 were civilians. Of the 85 civilians, 20 were women, 6 were children. One child and one man had died on the operating theater during surgery. Most of the children were pretty badly hurt. One little girl had a shrapnel from an American bomb in her spine, and her left leg was paralyzed. Her mother, rather pathetically, was trying to straighten her right leg against it, as if both her legs pointed in the right direction, she should somehow recover the movement of the left side of her body, which, of course, she did not. Other children were on drip feeds and had very serious leg injuries. One little girl had shrapnel in her abdomen, which had not yet been removed. And they were clearly in pain. There was a lot of tears and crying from the children, less so from the young women who had been hit. One woman was actually 70. They weren't all young. In one case, a woman and her daughter were there. The woman said to me that she'd gone to see a relative, and she'd got out of the taxi. A little daughter, whom I also spoke to, was in front of her, and there was a tremendous explosion, noise and white light, as the woman said. The girl was hit in the legs, and the woman was hit in the chest and legs by shrapnel. They were lying next to each other in hospital beds. This is not the worst kind of injuries I've ever seen, and I've seen just about every injury in the world, including people who've virtually got no heads left that are still alive, and I didn't see that. But, you know, if you're going to bomb a country, you will wound and kill civilians. That is in the nature of warfare. We bomb, they suffer. And it was nothing I saw in that hospital surprised me.
Well, Robert Fisk, we're going to let you go to sleep. General Colin Powell said that foreign journalists should leave as the campaign of so-called shock and awe is initiated, and it has started. Why have you chosen to remain in Baghdad?
Because I don't work for Colin Powell. I work for a British newspaper called The Independent. If you read it, you'll find we are. Look, it's not the job of journalists to snap to attention to generals. I wrote a piece in my newspaper a couple of weeks ago saying that before the war began in Yugoslavia, the British Foreign Office urged journalists to leave and then said the British intelligence had uncovered a secret plot to take all reporters hostages in Belgrade. I decided this was a lie and stayed, and it was a lie. In Afghanistan, just before the fall of Kandahar, as I was entering Afghanistan, the British Foreign Office urged all journalists to stay out of Taliban areas and said the British intelligence had discovered a plot to hold all journalists hostages. Aware of Yugoslavia, I regarded this as a lie and pressed on to Kandahar, and it proved to be a lie. Just before the bombardment began here, the British Foreign Office said that all journalists should leave because British intelligence had discovered a plot by Saddam to take all journalists hostages, at which moment I knew I'd be safe to stay, because, of course, it was the usual lie. What is sad is how many journalists did leave. There were a very large number of reporters who left here voluntarily before the war, believing this meretricious nonsense. I should say that the Iraqis have also thrown quite a lot of journalists out as well. But I don't think it's the job of a journalist to run away when war comes just because it happens to be his own side doing the bombing. I've been bombed by the Americans and the British so many times now that it's not shock and awe, it's shock and bore, frankly.
Well, good night, Robert. Thanks very
good
much
night,
for spending
Amy.
This.
I'm going to bed. Good
okay,
night.
Thank you. And that was Robert Fisk speaking to us from Baghdad. from ground zero as the troops move in on Baghdad. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Robert Fisk of the independent newspaper in Britain, usually based in Beirut, veteran war reporter. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's program, video or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Now, finally, comment from our listeners. People have been calling in around the country. We only have time for one.
I'm Jean-Claude T. in Washington, D.C. I listen to you on WPFW. I'm a poet, and I'm putting out as much poetry as I can. I'd like to share one with you. Newsman, newsman, you speak of war as though it were a game. You talk of those who'll surely die, and some you call by name. Newsman, newsman, I see excitement in your eye. Stop and look and think about the children who will die. Some Americans are sounding just like a lawless mob. They talk of freedom and democracy, not of young lives that they will rob. Newsmen, newsmen, all singing the same song, saying, follow now our president, be he right or wrong. Newsman, newsman, hear your hollow laughter? When the bombs fall on Baghdad, think of the morning after. Think of the morning after. See the dead up in the tree. Will you hang your head in shame at what has come to be?
And I want to thank you for that, listener. And listeners and viewers, you can call us at 212-209-2999. I want to also welcome a lot of stations who are taking the expanded two-hour broadcast, public access TV stations, Fitchburg, Massachusetts, as well as Kalamazoo, Michigan, SPNN, Channel 15 in St. Paul, Minnesota, PATV in Iowa City, Channel 18, as well as Salem Access TV in Salem, Mass, and DUTV in Philadelphia. Radio stations WZBC in Boston, KUSP in Santa Cruz, WSQX in Binghamton, KRCB in Sonoma, and many more. Welcome to Democracy Now! Democracy Now!'s website is democracynow.org. Also, congratulations to Jeremy Scahill and Jackie Sewin for winning the 2003 National Federation of Community Broadcasters Golden Reel Award for Best National News Story, their report, Iraq Journal. And welcome back, Jeremy. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Mike Burke. Also, special thanks to Elizabeth Press, as well as Noah Reibel. We go out with Michael Franti singing Listener Supported. He'll be joining us in our studio on Thursday. Our website, democracynow.org, where you can look for the transcript and send it around to your friends of the conversation with Robert Fisk. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Thanks for listening.